You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Welcome to the 20s and 30s class. Everybody, I think, is for the most part regular attenders, but we have been in a three-week series on stuckness, which I think was pretty well teed off by Colton and then Will last week. And so I think what I wanted to do was we're going to talk about being stuck, but I wanted to talk about kind of like, how do we wrestle in being stuck? How do we deal with it? What are kind of like the psychological responses to that? And then what are the problems with that? So I thought Colton, he taught, I guess that was 2 weeks ago now, and he had kind of an interesting, I may just be paraphrasing this, but I don't know if any of y'all were here, but he said that, because I wasn't, and I just listened to it on the podcast, and he said, stuckness is kind of like, you know, basically your freedom of movement is gone. So you're just kind of like boxed in, you can't do anything about it, you're just stuck. I mean, it's almost one of those things, doesn't even need to be defined, but I thought, like, well, you know, thinking about it is, it's kind of interesting that way, where it's just like total absence of freedom. So I thought that was a pretty interesting way to think about it. And I thought, you know, Colton and Will did a great job of kind of explaining how this kind of works and, you know, the different buckets we find ourselves, career, family life, you know, even just personality, negative attributes we'd like to get rid of and we can't. We're just stuck in it. I thought that what we'd do, like I said, was talk about, you know, what does that look like? You know, you're stuck, you're in a job you hate, you're in a rough patch in, say, a marriage, in a relationship, in, you know, a sibling dynamic, whatever it is, and it seems like you can't do anything to sort of, like, get over that, right? It's like everything you do, it just kind of makes it worse. And so I thought I would illustrate this concept with a children's book. So Madison down here on the front row, my wife loves to check out children's books from libraries to read to our baby, who Marshall has, and to our older son, who's almost two. And this was kind of in the grab bag, and it's a book called Stuck, funnily enough. And the first time we read it, I just like, I thought it was hilarious. So I thought I'd share it with y'all, and I think it gives a pretty good illustration of this concept of stuckness. And I'll try to, like, you know, show the pictures and everything. I'm not an elementary school teacher, so I'm not great at, like, yeah, right. I do feel very librarian. Okay, Stuck by Oliver Jeffers. It all began when Floyd's kite became stuck in a tree. He tried pulling and swiping, but it wouldn't come unstuck. The trouble really began when he threw his favorite shoe to knock the kite loose, and that got stuck too. So, he threw up his other shoe to knock his favorite one, and unbelievably, that got stuck as well. In order to knock down his other shoe, Floyd fetched Mitch. Mitch is a cat, for the audio. Cats get stuck in trees all the time, but this was getting ridiculous. Floyd fetched a ladder. He was going to sort this all out once and for all. And up he threw it. I'm sure you can guess what happened. The ladder was borrowed from a neighbor and definitely needed to be put back before anyone noticed. And in order to do so, Floyd flung a bucket of paint at it. And wouldn't you know it, the bucket of paint got stuck. Then Floyd tried a duck to knock down the bucket of paint, a chair to knock down the duck, his friend's bicycle to knock down the chair, the kitchen sink to knock down his friend's bicycle, Floyd's front door to knock down the kitchen sink, the family car to knock down their front door, the milkman to knock down the family car, and orangutan to knock down the milkman, who surely had somewhere else to be. a small boat to knock down the orangutan, a big boat to knock down the small boat, a rhinoceros to knock down the big boat, a long-distance truck to knock down the rhinoceros, the house across the street to knock down the long-distance truck, a lighthouse to knock down the no-longer-across-the-street house, a curious whale in the wrong place at the wrong time to knock down the lighthouse. And they all got stuck. A fire engine was passing and heard all the commotion. The firemen stopped to see if they could help at all. And up they went. First the engine, followed by the firemen, one by one. And there they stayed, stuck between the orangutan and one of the boats. Firemen would definitely be noticed missing, and Floyd knew he'd be in big trouble. Then he had an idea and went to find a saw. He lined it up as best he could and hurled it up the tree. And that was it. There was no more room left in the tree, and the kite came unstuck. Floyd was delighted. He had forgotten all about his kite and put it to use immediately, enjoying the rest of his day very much. That night, Floyd fell asleep, exhausted, though before he did, he could have sworn there was something he was forgetting. And there you have it, stuck. So, kind of a cutesy illustration, but I was struck by this of, we have like a problem that's presented in our lives. We're stuck in it, and I think it is, I find in my own life that I have a tendency, it's like, all right, I got to do something about this. I have to fix it. I have to make it work. And you just start like throwing stuff at it, right? You don't just, it's like, well, so, you know, one problem becomes two problems and three problems. And so it's sort of like, it almost compounds on itself. You know, I was thinking more about this later, but I was kind of my last job, I was starting to feel very stuck. And I'm a lawyer, and I applied to a job with like the Federal Railway Administration. It's like a remote job, so it's like, okay, well, that'd be cool, I guess, and I'd have good federal benefits and whatever. Obviously, never heard anything from that. It was just like a resume dump, but just kind of one of these things where it's like, I don't have any expertise in that. I've never worked for the federal government. I think that's a very like relatable experience where you just, well, I got to do something, right? And so I think there's this sense in our lives that we have to be kind of fixing ourselves, right? Of doing being proactive, right? Not looking complacent and not, you know, falling behind. I think, you know, so often we just end up kind of making things worse, but it's very relatable. I mean, I do that. I think everybody does that. So I thought, you know, kind of that being one sort of way to think about this, I thought a lot to kind of bring it towards scripture. I thought a lot about Jacob. And I think probably you all know his story, his account in the Bible, but there's a lot in there, and it's very rich and frankly, kind of, some of it's a little disturbing, just if you think about it from a contemporary perspective. But I think on y'all's handout, I kind of did like a quick sort of like almost like ChatGPT level summary of like the first half of Jacob's life. And Genesis is an enormous book. So I attempted to summarize like, I don't know, like 8 chapters of Genesis in 3 sentences. So, you know, that always a risk there, but really what I wanted to, and where I'm leading to is kind of sort of the climactic moment of Jacob's life where he really kind of, is sort of brought to like a new person. But kind of to get to that point, I wanted to kind of briefly sort of walk through his life and, kind of sort of demonstrate, I think he kind of typifies this pattern too of someone who like gets stuck, like sort of through his own sort of guile and cunning is able to kind of tip the sort of, he's kind of like art of dealing his way through life, and just able to kind of always like come out on the upper hand. And then he sort of finally gets to this place where he can't really do that anymore. And is truly like stuck, boxed in. And I think there's some real power in that, which we'll get to. So kind of the first part I really thought was like, as I probably put down, was sort of like Jacob is, he's born into this family where, you know, it's Abraham, it's Isaac, and then it's Jacob and Esau, right? And so there's this family blessing that starts with Abraham and then goes down to Isaac, and then it would have gone to Esau because he was the firstborn. They were, Jacob and Esau were twins. And so Jacob, in as they grow up, basically Jacob kind of catches Esau in a moment of desperation and takes advantage of him. There's this story of him, Esau sells his birthright because he's basically hungry. And Jacob is like, oh, I'll make you some soup. You want some soup? And Esau is like, sure. And Jacob sort of says, well, what will you give me for it? And Esau, I guess, for some reason, gives away his right, his claim to the family firstborn and blessing. And so Jacob, seizing the opportunity when his father gets older, goes in and manages to deceive Isaac, who is basically blind, and gets the family blessing in Esau's stead. Esau finds out about this, is furious, and Jacob flees and goes to what I have called sort of Act Two. He goes to his uncle Laban. And so almost immediately upon kind of getting to Laban's country, Jacob falls in love with Rachel, Laban's daughter, and goes to Laban to ask for permission to marry her, basically. And Laban's like, oh, yeah, well, of course, but you're going to have to work for me for 7 years for that. And so Jacob does. And then Laban, who is about as cunning as Jacob is, deceives Jacob, and you know, details are murky here, and slips in Rachel's older sister, Leah, into the tent. Jacob doesn't realize, is furious, and says, what have you done? And Laban's like, well, you know, it's not customary in our culture to give away the younger daughter first, so, you know, I had to. So there's that, and then so Laban's like, but I'll give you Rachel if you work for me for another 7 years. And so Jacob does that, and now he has two wives, and through kind of understandable rivalry, they begin to sort of like have basically they just sort of have like a baby off, more or less. And so Leah has four sons by Jacob, and then Rachel is understandably kind of on the outs, and so then she kind of pawns off a servant to Jacob, and Jacob has sons through the servant, and then Leah sees that and has her servant do the same, and so Jacob has more sons with the servant, and then Rachel gets pregnant, and so out of all of this, there's like 11 sons born, and so Jacob has all of these children, and then Jacob is finally saying, all right, I'm ready to go back to my country, and God appears to him, and he goes to Laban and says, I'm ready to leave. Basically, what do I owe you? And Laban says, oh, nothing. You know, you can take what's yours, basically. And so Jacob tries to get this. He's like, well, let me have this other flock of sheep. There's kind of a different color sheep. And Laban says, oh, yeah, that's fine. Well, Laban double crosses him, takes the sheep. And so, at the end of all that, Jacob then comes up with this ingenious scheme, and it's kind of complicated. Honestly, I have to read it several times to understand exactly how it works. But Jacob basically gets these group of sheep to breed, and he takes those and gets them away from Laban, and then he has this huge flock. He has all his sons and their servants, and they leave. Laban finds out, chases them, and then Jacob and Laban basically kind of have a sort of heated exchange, and then but Jacob gets the upper hand because God has been with him this whole time, and Laban says, well, look, I'm not touching you. You know, I know you have like basically God's special blessing, which he had received from Isaac, and so Jacob is returning to his home country. And so that's kind of like a ton of backstory. Forgive my Wikipedia page level analysis of the Jacob story. But I wanted to get to this point, which is really it's printed out here in your handout. And this is Genesis 32, because I think this is kind of like the sort of moment where Jacob is like truly in sort of like an existential survival kind of mode of like just total stuckness. Like, he is going to meet Esau, who had been furious at him and had threatened to kill him years before, and so Jacob is now preparing to meet him. So Tommy, would you actually be willing to read this Genesis 32, or if you want to read like half of it, and I can pick up where you want to stop.
Okay. Then Jacob sent messengers on ahead to his brother Esau in the land of Seir and Edom. He instructed them, "Tell my master Esau this, a message from your servant Jacob. I have been staying with Laban and couldn't get away until now. I've acquired cattle and donkeys and sheep, also men and women servants. I'm telling you all this, my master, hoping for your approval." The messengers came back to Jacob and said, "We talked to your brother Esau, and he's on his way to meet you, but he has 400 men with him." Jacob was scared, very scared. Panicked, he divided his people, sheep, cattle, and camels, into two camps. He thought, if Esau comes on the first camp and attacks it, the other camp has a chance to get away. And then Jacob prayed, "God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, God who told me, 'Go back to your parents' homeland and I'll treat you well. I don't deserve all the love and loyalty you've shown me. When I left here and crossed the Jordan, I only had the clothes on my back, and now look at me. Two camps. Save me, please, from this violence of my brother, my angry brother. I'm afraid he'll come and attack us all, me, my mothers, and children, and the children. You yourself said, 'I will treat you well. I'll make your descendants like sands of the sea, far too many to count.'" He slept the night there. Then he prepared a present for his brother Esau from his possessions: 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 camels with their nursing young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put a servant in charge of each herd and said, "Go ahead of me and keep a healthy space between each herd." Then he instructed the first one out, "When my brother Esau comes close and asks, 'Who is your master? Where are you going? Who owns these?' Answer him like this: 'Your servant Jacob. They are a gift to my master Esau. He is on his way.'" He gave the same instructions to the second servant and to the third, to each in turn as they set out with their herds. "Say, 'Your servant Jacob is on his way behind us.'" He thought, "I will soften him up with the succession of gifts. Then when he sees me face to face, maybe he'll be glad to welcome me." So his gifts went before him while he settled down for the night in the camp. But during the night, he got up and took his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He got them safely across the brook along with his possessions. But Jacob stayed behind by himself, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he couldn't get the best of Jacob as they wrestled, he deliberately threw Jacob's hip out of joint. The man said, "Let me go, it's daybreak." Jacob said, "I'm not letting you go till you bless me." The man said, "What's your name?" He answered, "Jacob." The man said, "But no longer, your name is no longer Jacob. From now on it's Israel, God Wrestler. You've wrestled with God and you've come through." Jacob asked, "And what's your name?" The man said, "Why do you want to know my name?" And then right then and there, he blessed him. Jacob named the place Peniel, God's face, because he said, "I saw God face to face and lived to tell the story." The sun came up and he left Peniel, limping because of his hip. This is why Israelites to this day don't eat the hip muscle, because Jacob's hip was thrown out of joint.
That's good. Yeah. So this is really the climactic moment of Jacob's life. He has managed to, kind of all his life, through kind of his own sort of cleverness, his own ability to persevere, to outfox. He basically takes the family blessing from his brother, deceives his father, and gets away with it, right? That's kind of like scene one. Scene two, he goes through this like very complicated and protracted, almost 20-year-long sort of, what would you call it? It's almost like a sort of a like a spy versus spy thing with his uncle Laban, and sort of he has these wives. He finally gets Rachel, who is kind of his true love, and then even though Laban himself is very clever and you know very kind of double dealing, Jacob finally basically gets the upper hand over him, gets away, and is all set to go back, and then. You know, when he's truly in this sort of terrible moment where he thinks, you know, Esau's coming with all these men to basically come kill me, take what we have, he meets God. And we don't really see, you know, like in the text itself, like, I'm God, you know, like incarnate, like wrestling with you. But it's very obviously implied based on what Jacob reports. I saw God face to face and lived to tell the story. And what do we see God do? It's sort of like he sort of lets him win, maybe, and then all of a sudden, boom, I gotcha. So I'm going to read this because I think this says it so much better than what I just did. This is a sermon by Frederick Buechner, who's just great. He's absolutely recommended. He has some really interesting novels and some great sermons, but I'll read it. And then it happens, out of the deep of the night, a stranger leaps. He hurls himself at Jacob, and they fall to the ground, their bodies lashing through the darkness. It is terrible enough not to see the attacker's face, and his strength is more terrible still, the strength of more than a man. All the night through they struggle, in silence until just before morning, when it looks as though a miracle might happen. Jacob is winning. The stranger cries out to be set free before the sun rises. Then, suddenly, all is reversed. He merely touches the hollow of Jacob's thigh, and in a moment, Jacob is lying there, crippled and helpless. The sense we have, which Jacob must have had, that the whole battle was from the beginning fated to end this way, that the stranger had simply held back until now, letting Jacob exert all his strength and almost win, so that when he was defeated, he would know that he was truly defeated, so that he would know that not all the shrewdness, will, brute force that he could muster were enough to get this. Jacob will not release his grip. Only now, it is not the grip of violence, but of need, like the grip of a drowning man. The darkness has faded just enough so that for the first time he can dimly see his opponent's face, and what he sees is something more terrible than the face of death, the face of love. It is vast and strong, half ruined with suffering and fierce with joy. The face of man flees down all the darkness of his days until at last he cries out, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Not a blessing that he can have now by the strength of his cunning or the force of his will, but a blessing that he can have only as a gift. Power, success, happiness, as the world knows them, are his who will fight for them hard enough. But peace, love, joy are only from God. And God is the enemy whom Jacob fought there by the river, of course, and whom in one way or another we all of us fight. God, the beloved enemy, our enemy because before giving us everything, he demands of us everything. Before giving us life, he demands our lives, ourselves, our wills, our treasure. I remember reading that and just being kind of knocked off my feet. Just how beautiful that is of God really coming to us and totally kind of blowing up our lives. And I think, you know, you see this in kind of how God came to Jacob in his moment of just like total stuckness, just saying, you know, you cannot get out of this yourself. It's not possible. I have to do this for you. And I have to get you so face down in the mud that you just sort of say, "Uncle, but bless me," right? I don't have anything else. So, I thought I would give you kind of a briefly, I think we're okay. Yeah, we still got 5 or so minutes. Kind of an illustration for my own life, that, and I'll probably just read it because it's a little easier to not lose all the details. So, and I think was really, this is kind of a season of being stuck in sort of my work life, and kind of feeling like, well, I don't really know how else this could have happened except God just sort of did it. So, 1 year ago, I was in a really tough place. I couldn't see the other end of where I was or where I was going to go. I had an almost one-year-old son and loved and still do my wife and our life together. But I was in an incredibly tough place at work, falling behind, not finding purpose in what I was doing, unsure how to handle all my roles as a husband, father, worker, servant of God, and drowning in a never-ending workload. All of this came to a boil over the summer. Madison and I were heading to a family vacation in Utah that had been on the calendar for months. My team had been so busy that I hadn't even bothered telling them I was going on vacation, figuring they would just email me anyway and it wouldn't matter. That was the culture. Go on your vacation and be prepared to log another 4 to 5 hours when you weren't out doing things during the day. What was the point of even trying to set a boundary? Bad idea. That mistake led to one of the worst fights of our marriage. Almost as bad, I was staying up until nearly midnight, multiple nights in a row, working on things for a boss that I wasn't connecting with well. In the midst of all this, I was considering a new opportunity in a different professional direction. It wasn't as flashy as the job I had. I wouldn't be in a downtown office on the top floor of a building. I wouldn't be a litigator standing up and yelling, "I object!" at the top of my voice. I never actually did that. But I'd be working with regular people, like you and me, to help them work through their legal problems. Not just massive corporate clients with immense market share who could care less if I existed or not. And yet I hesitated. I was afraid, not without reason, for the change it would bring my family, my wife, our now two children, as of last October. And I was leaving some decent benefits, including a long paternity leave, on the board. Just after the 4th of July, I can only describe it as follows. God showed up. I was in the middle of a work day at my old job when, out of the blue, two partners I worked with regularly walked into my office and shut the door. Totally unexpected. "Well, it's been a good run, I guess," I told myself, assuming I was about to be fired. But, as it turned out, they were leaving my old firm, effective that very day, to go to a rival firm. Because of the ethical issues involved, they couldn't tell me until the very last minute of their plans. So that very hour, all the work I had been doing for my old team, and all the partners on my old team, all the stress, left, and it was, as they say in the business, pencils down. The absolute relief was palpable. I was free. I could follow them to the new firm, stay at my old firm, or choose the new opportunity. How about that for options? In the end, I suppose I followed my heart. I went in the new direction, and I love what I get to do. It's been a long time since I've been able to say that. Are all my problems solved? Definitely not. But, as Madison and I had prayed for many, many months before that moment last July, we were looking for abundant clarity about our lives moving forward. And I should credit Leslie Hausman with giving us that abundant clarity kind of prayer direction. It was something only God could do. I couldn't have orchestrated this by my own efforts or scheming. God had to bring me to the end of myself to lead me to greener pastures. In the end, with the only grip I had left, I said, "I won't let go until you bless me." So, kind of applying it to yourself. Well, how do you do this, right? Well, you don't just do it, right? It's not Nike. It's sort of the opposite of Nike. Just kind of as a conclusion, a few psalms that came to mind. Psalm 77. I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. Right? Just continuing, like, just wearing God out. You know, where are you at? Come on, God. I need you to show up. Psalm 127, a great promise. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. And last one, I mean, Psalm 139, this is just like the greatest hits album of the Psalms. This one's like track one, maybe. I don't know, maybe Psalm 23. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. So this image, it's God who ultimately, I think, in some providential way sort of brings us to the end of ourselves and our stuckness. And it's God who rescues us. He He never leaves us. Even though it takes a long time for him to finish his work, and I'm kind of saying this to myself, God is faithful and provides the way out. So I think we're probably out of time. I heard the bells, so, you know, time to... but, Marshall, did you have a...
I did.
You have a thought?
The turning point was a blessing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe we could provide a blessing to everybody in this room.
Hmm. Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, yeah. I like it.
May I?
Yeah, yeah, please.
Lord, thank you for Ben's words. What an encouragement to know that you are chief over our lives. And with the authority that you give to the priesthood of all believers, I bless those in this room with motion and a turning point by the Holy Spirit to move forward in with a guiding light and vision that only you can provide. That their lives may be, that they may live life to the full in Christ with the joy and peace and guidance of that which can only come from you. Amen.
Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.